You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society, and today is Wednesday, March 14th, 2007. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Harry DeAngelis.
Eve.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, my friends.
Hey, Evan.
How is everyone this evening?
Well, Jay is back.
Good.
With us.
I'm back.
Terra firma, the 48 contiguous.
I'm back and I'm almost black. I got so tanned by accident there. I wasn't even trying.
It's sunny in Hawaii. I'm shocked.
Was it hot?
No. Hawaii is probably the best place on Earth. It's beautiful.
Just a big hole in the ozone over the island? Or?
It's a peculiar place because it's too good. It's too beautiful. The weather's too perfect. The people are too nice. Anyone that can go. I went to Maui. Every island is different from what I heard. I just went to Maui, but Maui was gorgeous. It was gorgeous.
Jay, you were supposed to report back on some pseudoscience in Hawaii. Did you succeed in finding any pseudoscience in paradise?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I did speak to a few people. I had a couple of issues that I was looking for answers for. So let me... All right, without going into too much detail, there's a very, very well-believed myth that if you take lava rock from Hawaii, you get cursed. Mm-hmm. So I did a little research. I mean, you could do this. Anyone could do this. I didn't have to go to Hawaii to do the research. But the basic research is Pele is the volcano god of the Hawaiian people. And Pele, from the things that I've read and the people that I spoke to, the people believe that Pele is kind of like the grantor of the food and fruits and the beauty of Hawaii. And Pele granted the people the lava, which is the island, in a different way to look at it. And through that, the gift that she gave, if you take the lava, if you take any lava rock with you, you're...
It's a woman?
Yeah. Pele curses you for taking her gift to the Hawaiian people. So you're not supposed to leave the island with it, right? This woman, I think her mother was born on Hawaii, and her mother, she told me this story about her mother left Hawaii and then came back and took some lava rock, and she actually...
She exploded.
Well, that would have been pretty cool. The woman actually mailed back the lava rock. And I remember Bob saying before I left that he heard that as well. So what did I do? I actually had to mail something when I was in Hawaii, and, you know, there's a post office there because it's the United States, so... I go in, I mail it.
It's the United States.
Yeah, because they don't have post offices outside the United States.
You know what I mean. It's funny because
they don't have U.S. post offices.
You don't. It's so tropical, you don't think you're in the United States. But anyway, so I'm in there, and I'm just basically sending a letter. I'm buying one stupid stamp from the guy, and I'm like, hey, can I ask you a question? I said, I heard that people mail back the lava rock. And he said, yeah, they do. As a matter of fact, Every post office there has a big outdoor storage unit just for the lava rock that they get. And at the end of the year, they all basically like take a day and they all unbox it and they, you know, I guess they put it back to where the lava where a lot of the lava rock is on whatever island that they're on. So it's big enough that, you know, they're getting thousands and thousands of packages, and it's a big deal for them to handle it. So they,
yeah,
instead of doing it every day, they only handle unpackaging it once a year. So that's a lot of lava rock that people take and send back because people believe the story of the curse of the lava rock, and I found out that story was actually made up by one of the park rangers that was working. A guy's name was Russ Apple, and he was a Volcano National Park ranger, and he made up the story.
And how did you find that out?
I found that on the internet, and someone in Hawaii told me. I think a park ranger may have made it up, that there was the only person there that actually, you know, that I met that lived there that didn't believe it. I spoke to a park ranger about another park ranger about it, and I also spoke to her about the Menahune, and those are basically the Hawaiian, the legendary and mystical like forest dwellers, and they're supposed to be like leprechauns. That's everyone.
Like Hawaiian leprechauns.
Yeah. And the real quick on them is, and these two stories kind of mix, so I'm just going to give the real quick on them.
Get over here, Lattie. I've got a lay for you.
This is off with me, pot of lava.
They're actually, some people think that they actually did exist historically that it was the fables came from people that actually did exist, you know, way back in the history of when people first started to populate Hawaii and everything. But basically,
but they were pygmies?
No. They never found any excavations that they've done. They never found any skeletons of any smaller creatures or anything, any humanoids like that. But
no Lucky Charms.
They're attributed to doing things like accomplishing big feats of work at night when nobody sees them.
They have big feet in Hawaii too.
Oh Christ! So basically, they are what Perry's describing. They're like the little people. They do things at night. Nobody, you know, they don't want to be seen, and they're attributed to making like a fish pond and temples and all these different things. So finally, I'm talking to a park ranger. I'm finally at the lava flow. I'm in my absolute vacation bliss. I'm like looking at freaking lava flow. I'm like, oh God, this is incredible. So I go, oh, there's a park ranger. So I go and I talk to the park ranger. So I'm like, so what do you hear about the, you know, people take lava rock and what's going on with that? And she's like, oh yeah, you can't take the lava rock. She goes, first off, it's against the law. I'm like, okay, well, that's understandable. And then she said, but you know, everybody mails it back because they get the curse. There's letters. They write in letters. They basically describe the curse. You know, they send it back and like, please take this and whatever. So I'm like, okay. So she believed it. So then yeah. I'm like, all right. Well, you know, enough with that one. So what's up with the Menahuna? And she's like, listen. You know, they're no joke either, because there's things that happen at the park. Like we'll come in the morning and stuff will have gotten done.
Like the shoes are all made.
Like pathways are cleared and, you know, the underbrush is cleared, whatever. Like things around the park get done. And she's like, and no one admits to doing it. So, you know, I don't know. I think I wouldn't discount them. She totally believed it. You know, let's cut through the crap. This park ranger went to Hawaii and believes all the local legends, which I was actually shocked because I was hoping that.
She went native.
Yeah.
She got orders from the Bush administration to tell people that. So.
I was going to say, maybe she had an occupational conflict of interest, you know, trying to keep up the excitement about the park.
Yeah, I thought that too. But if you were there, you know, I think
You looked into her eyes and she was a believer.
The tone of her voice and the way there was a romanticism behind it. You know, I mean, let's cut through the crap, Perry. She flew from the mainland to go to Hawaii and is sitting literally on a folding chair with a bunch of brochures on it, like telling people about lava rock. She loves this.
Well, Jay, thank you for that fascinating report from Hawaii and taking time out of your vacation to do that on-the-spot investigation. We got some news items this week. Recently, we talked with Kenny Fader about the Tomb of Jesus. Director Cameron is doing a documentary about this, and we complained that he was bypassing the peer review process and basically taking some unvalidated science directly to the public. Well, it didn't take very long for the peer review wheels to start grinding away. Already, there is a publication calling into question some of the bits of evidence. So again, very quickly, that these are the they're ossuaries, you know, bone boxes found in a grave in Jerusalem that dates to about 2,000 years ago, to about the right time. The inscriptions on several of the tombs and several of the ossuaries in one tomb were interpreted as Jesus, son of Joseph, Mary of Magdalene, and Judah, which they thought might have been the son of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Well, it turns out, of course, you know, James Cameron is claiming this is the tomb of the biblical Jesus. A paper published by Stephen Fan corrects the translation of the name Mary Magdalene, and he claims that it reads Miriam and Mara, two separate names. And it was actually very common practice to put multiple individuals into the same ossuary. So as further evidence for this, he shows pretty convincingly that the two names were written by different people at different times. They're written in different handwriting, if you will.
Like as if it happened over different periods of time. Then,
yes, right. Like 100 years later, Mara was put in the same bone box and her name was scrawled, you know, after Miriam by a different hand. So we'll have a link to the actual paper. It's actually even for somebody for whom this is not, it's not that technical. You know, a layperson can follow the arguments, and it's pretty visual. You could see the script. So, of course, if that's true, that completely obliterates the entire Tomb of Jesus claim right there.
Care to comment, Mr. Cameron?
Yeah, perhaps they made an honest mistake.
Right. Well, I mean, you mean Cameron?
Yes.
Well, sure. He made an honest mistake. The whole point was, before you make a documentary to show to the world, scientists like Fan, looking at the details and going, gee, this translation doesn't quite add up. And look at this is a different script. And
scientists get in the way of so many good stories. I mean, it's just easier to go around them.
And at this point, he's about the truth. Right? He's like halfway through his documentary, and he's like, oh, it doesn't say Jesus.
They're not going to be convinced by one guy anyway. I don't care.
Well, anyway, that didn't take very long.
You know what happened. He saw the cash cow that...
Might not even have been money. He's already richer than Jesus. It's just a matter of he was excited.
It drew very high ratings. Ratings for Discovery. So they
thought
cashed
he had
in.
Something, and that was it. He let it run away with him. He's not a scientist. He doesn't care.
Quick follow-up on another news item. We had talked last year about the demotion, if you will, of Pluto from being a planet to being an icy dwarf.
Very sad. Very sad.
So now we're down to 8 planets in the solar system. Pluto was demoted. The state of New Mexico recently passed Resolution House Joint Memorial 54, which basically says that in New Mexico, Pluto is a planet.
Oh, come on.
Bill Richardson.
They've also outlawed graffiti.
This is all part of his presidential bid, of course. He's going for the planet's rights people.
That makes a nice precedent. Yeah, let's redefine scientific terms. Just extrapolate that. Why can't they just embrace Pluto's dwarf planet status?
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
They could have Dwarf Day in New Mexico or something. I mean, Pluto now is in more of a select group. There's only 3 dwarf planets, but there's 8 regular planets. I don't know.
It's true.
They just got to deal with it.
Well, I mean, I think the reason that New Mexico is interested in this is because the guy who discovered Pluto is from New Mexico. What was his name?
The observatory guy.
Disney.
Jack Pluto.
Percival Lowell.
Not Percival Lowell.
Percival Pluto?
Yeah, Percival
Lowell. Percival Lowell?
Pluto.
Yes. I thought he was from Massachusetts.
Why would they do this, though, really? Why would anyone think that this is an important thing to do?
It was a point of pride for them, and they want to kind of reclaim that.
Percival Lowell was from Massachusetts. He was from Lowell, but his observatory is in New Mexico.
After this whole thing went down with Pluto, I realized it's not a demotion. It's just a classification change, and who really cares?
It's science doing what science does.
And speaking of the fact that I'm right about who discovered Pluto, Pluto was named Pluto. One of the main reasons why it was so quickly embraced is because...
A kid named it. Yeah, we know.
No, because it's Percival Lowell's initials start the word.
Oh, I thought it was based on the old god.
Okay, here's the actual facts. The search for the ninth planet was begun by Percival Lowell, and he built an observatory in New Mexico, the Percival Observatory, in 1905. However, Pluto wasn't discovered until after Lowell's death by Clyde Tombaugh, who discovered it in 1930.
There you go.
Evan, you sent me this next piece. This one is on robot rights.
The ethical dilemma of robotics. Very interesting.
What does it say?
Scientists are already beginning to think seriously about the new ethical problems posed by current developments in robotics. So, right there, I'm like, I was thinking to myself, I had no idea there was really an ethical issue with robotics in real science. It always comes up as a theme in science fiction, but I thought it was isolated there, frankly. I didn't realize there was a true devotion of people out there who really extensively study this.
Well, they don't want them working all the time? What?
No, it's more like when they become really intelligent and self-aware, should they have the rights of a citizen or a person?
Right, and...
They're discussing that now?
Perry, it's probably saying it's a little premature.
It's probably the Democrats, right, Perry?
They feel that robotic sentience is on the precipice.
Well, here's a line from the article. As these robots become more intelligent, it will become harder to decide who is responsible if they injure someone. Is the designer to blame, or the user, or the robot itself?
There cannot be an ethical robotic gap.
You are hereby found guilty. You will be unscrewed, repackaged, and sent back to your manufacturer. What are they talking about? Whoever set the thing up, whoever was running it, what is this? Is crazy. Cross it off. Ridiculous.
No,
next.
Perry, it's not ridiculous.
It does seem a little. It's a little premature.
It might be a little premature,
but
let's talk.
20 years. This could be serious.
Yeah,
business.
Why not just start talking about it now and figure out what?
20 years? You think robot sentience is 20 years away? That they're going to be self-aware?
We don't, Perry. We don't know.
There are some people who project.
We
that.
Don't know.
But that even let's say it's 50 years.
I know. Let's say it's stupid. Yeah. Not going to be self-aware 20 years. It's ridiculous.
You know, Perry, do you know how powerful computers are going to be in 20 years?
Very powerful.
Yeah, computers and birds, they're all self-aware.
What if – it's actually not as hard as you might think. You know, we'll definitely have the computing power in the 2020s or 2030s. And all you really have to do is figure out some way to model it after a human brain. You don't even have to understand how the brain works. You just need to figure out some way to mirror it. And there you go. Boom. You got self-aware computer.
But guys, let's all answer the question. I want to hear everybody's opinion on this. Let's start with Bob. Bob, what do you think? Computers become conscious, you know, in some manner of speaking, like humans. What do they get equal rights?
I think eventually they will be afforded rights. I think there's going to be a lot of inertia. There's going to be a lot of – it's going to be very hard to get to that point, and people are going to fight against it. But eventually I think people will acquiesce. You know, it'll be obvious. You know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, eventually people will realize, well, all right, there's something here. We got to do something about it, afford them some rights, whether it's the equivalent of, you know, monkey rights or
yeah. But don't you think
like
we
that.
Should have a good 100 years of raw robot slavery before we give them any rights? Or
a few decades, not a century.
What do you think, Steve?
I don't think that we should make self-replicating, fully automated, self-aware robots. Otherwise, we're just asking for the Matrix.
Yes, I agree.
We're just asking for the robot takeover of human civilization.
Have I wandered into a science fiction convention?
I was
what
actually
are
starting
you people
to think
talking
the same
about?
Thing. I can't believe I'm on Perry's side on this, but you guys
what
are all
are
freaks.
You people
we're just asking for the
about?
Matrix. We're asking for a dystopian future.
Get out!
I'm only slightly
all right.
crazy.
Cylons, so. You know, whatever. Pick your robot takes over civilization.
Cybermen.
Oh,
no.
What do you think?
I'm not sure what to think about this. I mean, what if someone wants to turn a robot off and the robot has a right to be left on? I mean, if it comes to a point like that,
would that be murder?
Right. Well, what? How? Who's going to make? Who's going to determine these lines in the sand?
We do.
There's other scenarios too. Jay, what about this? What if you have your personality, memories, everything completely uploaded to a computer? Is that computer then you? Does that computer own your property or carry on your?
Am I still alive?
Well, those are two different scenarios. There's one where you are alive too. There's one where you're not.
Look, unless it's made of meat, I don't care.
I like how Isaac Asimov handled the whole thing. I like the three laws of robotics. I think they make sense. I think that humans should come first.
Rebecca, I did not think you were meat-centric.
I am made of meat, and that's what's
you guys
important.
Got this from the Star Trek where Riker tried to prove Data was a toaster, right?
Great episode. Great
that's
episode.
Where this is all coming from.
All right, but Jay, you're saying you're also drawing a sharp line between people and robots. What about when you know you have a computer implanted in your brain?
Well, whatever incarnation.
What about when that computer gets more powerful than your brain?
It
itself.
Boils down to wow. this: whatever I am, that wins. So if I'm a cyborg,
that's right. I think you're right. And that when people are more computer than meat, you know, then robots will think about that quite differently.
How far are we away from something like that?
3-4 years.
Depends on who you talk to. You know, we actually are in negotiations with Ray Kurzweil, and we will talk about this in a lot of detail when we have him on our show.
In negotiations? You make it sound yeah. It sounded like you were about to say like we were going to negotiate to have Perry turned into a robot.
That basically means we're trying to settle on a date.
Ray Kurzweil said, I'll speak to you, but you cannot use the word the.
or ones or zeros.
The last bit of news, just a quick one about you know, more nonsense coming from the Discovery Institute. So they're, of course, the quote-unquote think tank that promotes intelligent design. And one game that they're playing is that they are collecting names of quote-unquote scientists who are who question Darwinism or question descent from Darwinism or question evolution. And it's taken them years to get over 700 names, you know, out of the tens of thousands of scientists that there are. And most of the people on their list, like, aren't really biologists or evolutionary biologists. They don't know what they're talking about. Some are just have technical degrees. They're like engineers or doctors, but they don't really necessarily have any particular knowledge that would, you know, qualify them to make judgments about evolutionary evidence.
Some are just fruitcakes.
Some are just fruitcakes. But they like to send out press releases saying that the number of scientists who are dissenting from Darwin is growing because they're adding another name to their list, as if implying very deliberately, deceptively, that the percentage of scientists who are dissenting from Darwin is growing. What they really mean is that some jackass signed on to their list, so that list grew. Now, the particular jackass that signed recently, or at least the one that they're trotting out these days, is a neurosurgeon by the name of Michael Ignor.
And ignore him.
Again, he's Dr. Michael Ignor from SUNY Stony Brook, State University of New York, so the guy's a neurosurgeon. That does not in any way, in and of itself, qualify him to have an opinion about evolutionary biology. And he says the usual, you know, nonsensical things. You know, he doesn't have anything new to say. He's just parroting the Discovery Institute intelligent design propaganda. You know, for example, he said, they talk about information theory. You know, show me how genetic information can increase over time. There's no evidence that shows any way that any mechanism by which an information can increase over time. And in fact, there are thousands of published papers that show mechanisms for increasing genetic information evolutionarily, mainly, you know, showing that gene duplication has occurred, you know, over evolutionary history, you know, where a gene gets copied, so you have two copies of the gene. Well, that's an increase in information, and one of those copies is, you only need one copy, so the other copy is free to evolve in novel directions. So he's basically making claims that there is no evidence for this thing, when in fact, if he spent 5 minutes on the internet, he could have found hundreds or thousands of examples of what he's saying doesn't exist. In fact, you could find examples of it on PubMed, which is an online database of published scientific, you know, biological and medical journals, and a practicing physician should know how to use that. So he really has no excuse to be saying that he didn't know that this evidence was out there. This has been going around the blogosphere recently, and it's just, you know, more evidence of just blatant intellectual dishonesty and misdirection from the Discovery Institute.
And none of us are shocked.
Dr. Ignoramus. Gotcha.
Got it. We have to keep an eye on these guys, the intelligent design fools, because they're not going away. Let's move on to your emails and questions. The first email comes from Darren Ohashi, didn't give his location, and he writes, recently the infidel guy had an interview with Dr. Fred A. Bowman about what Dr. Bowman calls the fraud of ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. He claims that there is no disease behind ADHD and that the medication should not be prescribed for what are basically normal behaviors. His basic argument is that ADHD has no physiological manifestation, that is, you can't determine if someone has ADHD only by looking at their physiology, and thus it is not a quote-unquote disease, or even a disorder, which he claims is an equivalent term. Dr. Bowman definitely sounds like he has a problem with psychiatry, but if he's right, that might be justified. So he basically wants to know what we think about Dr. Bowman's attitude towards ADHD and, in fact, other psychiatric illnesses as well. This is, you know, a very interesting topic.
Been around a long time, too, this debate.
Yeah, it has.
It has.
This is, you know, and I've written about it before. You know, I believe that Dr. Bowman's attitude really is most fairly characterized as mental illness denial or psychiatry denial. I really don't think that his arguments are legitimate. By the way, I want to do a little bit of background check, because half the time when you're talking with somebody who is sort of this dedicated against the notion of mental illness, half the time they're Scientologists. Now, from what I found out, Dr. Bowman is not a Scientologist. However, he has consulted for front groups of the Church of Scientology, specifically the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, and he has received awards from the Church of Scientology.
But
he's not a Scientologist, and that could have been innocent on his part. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's in league with them, and doesn't say anything in and of itself about his arguments.
Would you accept an award from Scientologists if you were offered
one?
No,
of course not. But I think he should be more careful. That's kind of like if you're an evolutionary biologist and you have some fringe ideas about evolution, I wouldn't go accepting awards from the Discovery Institute. You know what I mean? That's kind of what he was doing. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is the arguments that he makes.
He's saying that there's no such thing at all. He's not saying that it's just overprescribed.
Right. He's saying it doesn't exist. Every one of his arguments are totally fallacious. And I've discussed this issue with psychologists, with dozens of people. I've been in email conversations with them far longer than I really should have been. But I really was trying to get down to the bottom of what they think and to see if I could put them into that sort of logical corner. And you know what? They argue like creationists. They really do. Even worse sometimes. I mean, it really is incredible. What they do, the typical thing where you try to focus on one point, and then when you show them logically that the point is not legitimate, they defend it by making another point. They basically lateral over to another point. And then if you address that point, they just lateral over again, just like creationists do. And they never quite really give you closure on the point that you were trying to make. And I've read some interviews with Dr. Bowman, he does make the standard arguments. The one argument is that ADHD is diagnosed by checking a list of symptoms. There's 16 different symptoms of ADHD, and if through just observation a child is shown to have 8 of them, that qualifies, or 9 of them, that qualifies them for the diagnosis. In other words, saying the diagnosis is made clinically by observing symptoms. There is no way to make the diagnosis by doing any kind of physiological, anatomical, biological test.
Kind of like a headache.
Right. So he's a neurologist. Dr. Bowman's a child neurologist. So, it's really incredible that a practicing physician can make that argument, because there are so many diseases and disorders. By the way, those are not the same thing. That we diagnose that way. I think the closest analogy is migraine headache. Migraine headache is diagnosed by checking off a number of symptoms. You have a certain number of symptoms of migraine, it's a migraine. If the MRI scan of your brain, EEG, if I sliced up your brain on the autopsy table, nothing would tell me that you have migraine. There's absolutely no way to see it with any kind of physiological test. So therefore, if you use that argument against the existence of ADHD, then you also have to apply it to a lot of other non-controversial, more mundane things like migraines. And, it is so clear that migraine exists as a clinical syndrome. I mean, people have a very consistent constellation of signs and symptoms. The problem here is that the mental illness deniers are looking at the brain as if it were the liver. And they're trying to tell me, they're trying to say, show me the abnormal cells. Show me the standard kinds of things that we use to diagnose a disease. The problem is that the brain has something that no other organ in the body has. The brain's function is also dependent upon the pattern of neuronal connections that are made in the brain, and the robustness of connections, and the activity of neurotransmitters, the density of receptors, and the physiology of those receptors. Those are things that we cannot image. And yet, if the difference between somebody who is brilliant at math and somebody who has absolutely no aptitude at math is in how their brain's wired up in that fashion. And it can't be visualized. There's absolutely no way to visualize it. But that's like saying there's no meaningful difference between math aptitude between different people or musical aptitude. Of course there is. Now, what ADHD is, ADHD is that it's a disorder of the frontal lobes, and the specific function that is disordered is called executive function. This is what gives us the ability to make plans and judgments about our actions, and so they basically look at the big picture of what we do and the consequences of what we do, and make, you know, good judgments for our life. It also gives us the ability to sort of focus our attention on a task for a prolonged period of time. And it varies, just like all, you know, mental functions vary, and some people just have really bad executive function. Now, at some point, it becomes so bad that it actually starts to have negative detriments, you know, detriments for your life. You have, you know, you don't do as well in school, you have a hard time holding down a job, you know, higher divorce rate, higher, you know, rate of use of illicit drugs, higher rate of being arrested and winding up in jail. I mean, there's actually, you know, very well documented real consequences to this. And at some, I think at some point, it's reasonable to say, all right, these people have, are at the low end of the spectrum in terms of their executive function, and it's causing, you know, these problems for their life. It's reasonable to call that a disorder. That's what ADHD is. ADHD is. Now, of course, there's no analogy with any other organ system in the body, because no other organ system functions like the brain. No other organ system is dependent upon that. So, you know, all of the criticism of it, the fact that it's diagnosed the way it is, that, you know, there aren't diseased cells or whatever, is completely irrelevant. It's all completely irrelevant. The other thing that, you know, that the mental illness and ADHD deniers do is they, and I've had some people that I've argued with for a long time who wouldn't even grant the notion that you can assign, you know, terms like healthy or unhealthy to behaviors. They're basically saying that, you know, thoughts and behaviors cannot be a disease. That's their mantra. You know, thoughts can't be a disease, which is, again, kind of a non sequitur. The fact is, thoughts, behaviors, and moods are created by the functioning of our brain, and the, you know, the hardwiring and biochemical function of our brain can be dysfunctional. I had one guy I was arguing with who wouldn't even allow the term dysfunctional. You know, it's like you can't, like, all function, everything's normal. Everything people do is normal. All function is function. It's all part of the human condition. And we can't assign any kind of, you know, healthy or unhealthy judgments on it. And that's, you know, that's just nonsense. I mean, it just flies in the face of logic. You know, organs were designed to function within certain parameters. If you're far enough out of those parameters, you know, and then it leads to problems, that's something that's reasonable to intervene on it. I try to get out of the semantic argument and just say, just from a practical point of view, if this isn't working and it's causing problems and I can make it work better and make the, and make those problems much less for you, what's the problem with that? I mean, that's a perfect, that's the, basically the approach with ADHD. Now, very quickly, just to give, you know, give you the whirlwind tour of the scientific evidence for ADHD, it's pretty clearly a genetic disorder. It's clearly a brain disorder. There's lots of evidence that shows that the parts of the brain that you think should be hypofunctioning are hypofunctioning on fMRI and EEG studies. You know, these are like real physiological studies. Of course, when you bring up those kinds of studies, you say, yes, but you can't use them to make a clinical diagnosis. They're not reliable enough to make a clinical diagnosis. And that is moving the goalpost. Because they're saying there's no physiological evidence. You give them physiological evidence that the brain's not functioning well in that part of the brain. And they go, yes, but it doesn't meet this other criteria that I just arbitrarily made up. Say, well, it's not reliable enough to make a clinical diagnosis. Well, yeah, that same is true of migraines. You know, we could look at migraineurs' heads. And yeah, you know, they don't behave quite the same as people who don't have a migraine. If you look at, you know, certain reflexes and certain neurotransmitter activity, but you can't, it's not really useful clinically as a diagnosis. It's only really in the realm of research at this point in time. Same exact thing, but so they pull the old moving the goalpost logical fallacy too, and it goes much deeper. I mean, there's a lot of depth to this denial, but it really has all of the earmarks of pseudoscientific denial. They use all the same logical fallacies. The core is, though, that they're not applying appropriate criteria to thinking about brain function, basically. So very, it's tough.
That was brutal.
It's very frustrating to talk to these people. It really is. I mean, I've argued with creationists. I've argued with mental illness deniers, and if anything, they're worse than creationists in my personal experience debating them.
I have a little anecdote that our audience might find interesting, connected with ADHD. Steve, you remember 6 or 7 years ago, we had, his name escapes me, a big guy in this field come down from Boston mm-hmm. to speak to our group in the days of our newsletter. and the newsletter didn't get out on time, and the word of mouth didn't get around, and this poor fella drove all the way down from Boston to a library in Norwalk, and we had about six people there.
Yeah.
You remember that was a real low point for the NES.
It was just logistically didn't work out. And it was also, we did it on the middle of the week, and we didn't know how that was going to work out.
Do you remember the guy's name, Steve? I don't remember. And it was a big book. He's a big guy. Well, maybe we can put it in. But how much better would it have been if he had sat in his office in Boston and called us for the podcast?
Yeah, actually, I was thinking of trying to get him for an interview. You know, he would be a good guy to interview.
He is. I have his name somewhere in the field.
Yeah, you know? I'd like to debate these guys too. You know, at some point in time in the future,
he's an advocate for ADHD.
This is his research field. Right. He does research in ADHD. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of the literature, and it was good to listen to him speak. We also had a psychologist on the other side who didn't believe in ADHD. Whenever he brought up a point, you know, he could cite chapter and verse the literature showing that no, that's true. The evidence shows that it is in fact, you know, a very genetically predetermined.
Steve, you had an ongoing debate with that guy for months with that psychologist.
Yeah.
In the newsletter, verbally.
On the NES website, there are point-counterpoint articles by him and by me on ADHD. So I'll put the links on the notes page to those as well, and you could sort of see the logic of how things goes. The next email comes from Stephen Randall from St. Petersburg, Florida, and he writes, "Hello, recently I read an article that states that a new theory has formed about how nerves communicate to each other. This theory abandons the idea that nerves use electrical impulses to send messages between one another and states that nerves use sound waves to send messages. My question is for Stephen Novella. What are your thoughts on the likelihood of this theory being shown true, and what would the implications be for medicine? Also, the article states that nerves do not generate heat when they supposedly fire electrical impulses. Is that statement correct? How would this be explained against thermodynamics? Finally, how would the sound theory explain electrical currents affecting muscle contractions and other nerve functions?" So this is a very interesting article, and I actually emailed the lead author on this article and asked him a series of questions to get his response. I'll have his full email response in the notes page. But basically, this is what he's saying.
I'm sorry, Steve. Where did the article appear?
The article was published in he sent me the original references. All right, so the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Biophysics Review.
So it was a peer-reviewed journal is my question.
Yeah.
Okay. He took the appropriate steps. He went on the appropriate
channels. This is legitimate science,
right?
But it's a very, very controversial notion. Now, what he's actually... Just to distinguish two things here, and I was confused about this too until I spoke with the guy. There are two types of nerve conduction in brain cells or nerves or neurons along an axon or along the wire, within the same cell, and then across a synapse where it connects to another cell or to a muscle. He's not talking about the synapse. He's not talking about the connection between cells, between nerves, or between nerves and muscles. He still says, that's electrical signals by neurotransmitters, by chemicals and receptors, etc. But he's saying that the conduction along the axon, along the neuron wire, if you will, that the classic, now classic model is that it's a saltatory conduction of electrical current, that, current is conducting through this insulated, nerve axon, jumping from sort of one node to another. What he's saying is that if that were happening, it should be generating heat, and studies have failed to find the heat that our theories say should be there. So he is proposing an alternate hypothesis that it's actually sound waves that are propagating down the axon, and then at the end they sort of activate the synapse, which sends the electrical signal. So that explains why you would still see electrical discharges on EEGs and why drugs that affect nerve synapses would still work, etc. I actually talked with some of my colleagues, including Steve Waxman, who's the chairman of my department at Yale and who does this kind of research. And, his reaction was, there's just too much science behind the old model to abandon it just because there's sort of this one anomaly. He couldn't make sense out of what this guy was saying. I think what we're seeing here is sort of the clash of two disciplines. Now, the lead author is a guy named Heimberg, And he's not a, a neuroscientist.
Is that the guy you spoke to, Steve?
I emailed, yeah. I emailed. He's a lead author on this article. He's not a neuroscientist. He is a physicist. And he's saying that that the physics don't make any sense. And he's trying to make sense of it from a physics point of view. But neuroscientists are like, well, you know, there's just tons of evidence and research, you know, backing up this, the electrical propagation part of this. You know, in fact, you know, there are sodium channels and their function is responsible for the conduction along the nerve. And there's just so much that derives from that. There are disorders that we know are disorders of abnormal sodium channels, and they affect nerve function. I mean, you can actually, you know, clamp the axons, like these little patch clamps, and measure their electrical activity and see that they're different. If things are different about them, that should affect the electrical conduction. So it's hard to make sense of this mountain of research if Thomas Heinberg's hypothesis is true. It certainly would be a bombshell, you know, in the world of neurology if it turns out to be true. I just think that the probability is very small. This kind of thing happens from time to time. It, you know, historically, when you have somebody who is looking at one small fact and saying this contradicts a large body of research in another field, you know, that has a very bad track record of being correct. I'm reminded of Lord Kelvin. He did some calculations and figured out that the Earth should have cooled much quicker than the geologists were saying. Geologists were saying that the Earth was hundreds of millions of years old at the time. Actually, it's even older still. And if that's true, the Earth should have cooled already, is what Lord Kelvin was saying. Therefore, the Earth must be only thousands of years old, and all of geology is wrong, basically. It turns out that this was before the discovery of
radioactive decay.
Radioactive decay, that's right. Once we discovered there are radioactive elements in there, radioactive decay is heating up the Earth enough that it's slowing down the cooling of the Earth, and that accounts for the discrepancy. But nobody knew that because we hadn't even discovered the radioactive materials at the time. So basically you have Kelvin taking this one fact, like that doesn't physically make sense, and saying this overrides all of the carefully collected science that the whole field of geology was doing over years. And the geologist's like, no way, this can't be wrong. The world has to be old. I get the same kind of vibe off of this, where we have this mountain of evidence saying that, you know, this is how nerves conduct electricity. And this guy is saying, there's this one physical anomaly which doesn't make sense. So I'm going to say that that's all wrong and that it's actually functions a completely separate way that doesn't really make any sense based upon our classic models. So I give that a very small probability of turning out to be true. I think there's probably some other explanation for why we're not measuring the heat that he thinks that we should be generating.
Is this an anomaly that you and your colleagues talked about prior to this article, Steve?
No.
The lack of heat.
First I ever heard of it.
Okay.
First I ever heard of it.
All right.
And, you know, and again, it may be true that it's something that neuroscientists don't care about, but a physicist notices it. And in fact, we may discover something interesting about how nerves function from this. I just don't think it's going to overturn everything we think is going on. You know what I'm saying?
It's a little Neil Adams-ish
I wouldn't quite put
no,
it.
I wouldn't put it in that category.
But I mean, you know.
Yeah, and the guy's being very, very reasonable. His email is very reasonable. And in fact, he was embarrassed about the press release. He's like, oh, you know, we don't usually do this, but the damn university went ahead with the press release. We usually talk in more professional sort of venues. So he was a little embarrassed, I think. Maybe he's getting more attention for this than he anticipated. But
he sounds reasonable.
Yeah. So this is an example of reasonable, you know, peer-reviewed science working out the way it's supposed to, you know. But I just don't think it's going to go the way he thinks. We have another name that logical fallacy this week. And I'm going to try to make an effort to keep these things coming. This one comes from Lauren Fox in Canada. And Lauren writes, I discovered your podcast last September and it is now one of the bright spots in my week. I love the mix of science and skepticism delivered with great banter and humor. She writes parenthetically, Rebecca rocks. I would ask her to marry me if I didn't already have a wonderful wife. I have a name that logical fallacy for you. My dad is a born-again Christian. He also doesn't like to go to doctors. He's been on the Atkins diet for 5 years. Well, that's the trifecta, isn't it? Here are some excerpts from two of our conversations. Although he is laughing and joking in these conversations, he really does believe what he is saying. So here's the conversation. Me being now Lauren. What about the studies on the health effects of the Atkins diet? My dad, do those doctors believe in evolution? I don't believe anything anyone who believes in evolution says. Later, why should I go to a doctor? Last time I went, they just gave me a lot of guff. Me. Maybe to get your cholesterol checked. My dad, I don't believe in cholesterol. Me. What? My dad, the same people that tell you about global warming tell you about cholesterol. Wow. Me. Al Gore tells you about cholesterol. So he basically wants to know what logical fallacy his father is committing.
He's every single one of them.
It might be the argument from anti-authority. Yeah, so this is it's under the category of an ad hominem, although sometimes this sub, which basically an ad hominem is when the kind of fallacy that is whenever you're saying someone's wrong because of some negative attribute that they have, whatever that negative attribute is, and there are subtypes based upon what the negative attribute is. In this case, he's saying this is sometimes referred to as poisoning the well or the company that you keep. You know that if you believe in one thing that's wrong, then everything you believe must also be wrong, right? So you're wrong because you believe in this other thing that I don't agree with. And of course, that's the logical fallacy because people could certainly be right about some things and wrong about others, and it doesn't necessarily follow that you have to be wrong about everything if you're wrong about one thing.
That's just ignorant.
And basically, he's making that both of those, I think, are the same one, that you know, if doctors believe in evolution, then you can't believe anything that they say. And anyone who believes in global warming, you know, you can't believe anything they have to say, right? And if they're also the same people, which I think is also a false premise, you know, that the two things I don't think have anything to do with each other. So it's a false premise is not a logical fallacy. It does make the argument unsound, right? An argument's unsound if any piece of it is wrong or invalid. You have an unsound argument from a false premise combined with a logical fallacy. So good luck dealing with dear old dad, Lauren.
He's going to need it.
Better you than me.
Yeah. Wow, that guy is... He's out of limits, man. Wait a minute. Guys, he actually said, I don't believe anything that anyone says if they believe in evolution.
Of course.
What the hell does that guy believe?
Believes we were planted here like geraniums, you know.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and you can play along. Are you guys ready for the three devious items this week?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
It's going to be tough. I'm warning you. This one's going to be tough. You ready?
Okay.
Number one.
I think we're ready.
Researchers have found they can decrease the hearing damage caused by very loud noises by pre-treating with an anti-epilepsy drug. Item number two. Scientists have discovered a new species of mammal 125 million years old, which they believe to be the long sought-after missing link in bat evolution. Item number three, scientists have proposed a new process for turning biomass into liquid fuel, and they claim that with this method, agricultural and forest waste could be turned into enough fuel to meet the U.S.'s entire transportation needs. Bob, go first.
It's tricky. I'm going to go with two. I think I would have seen something about the missing link for bats, because that's been a very key argument in a lot of creationists. Arguments saying that we don't even have any adequate fossil evidence to show the evolution of bats, and that's big news in the bat world, and I think I would have come across that, so I'm going to go with that. The other ones seem feasible enough.
Alrighty, Perry.
I agree with Bob.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, that article was conspicuously absent from this month's issue of Bat Month, so
Bat
I'm going to go
month.
With that one.
You are so lame.
Don't Jay? Mock my hobbies, Jay.
Bats are cool.
Steve, that last one,
they could turn agricultural and forest waste into enough gas to fuel the entire American fleet.
I remember reading something about it, but I don't remember them saying all of it. 100%. So.
Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Yeah. Bat Fancy.
Bat Fancy Monthly?
That's what I meant to say.
Okay, now
this month's
monthly.
Issue of Bat Fancy. Sorry, go ahead, Jay.
Shit. I'll go with the bats.
I don't want to imagine.
You boy. Lemming.
Evan.
Boy, I'm in a tough spot here. Either I join everyone, or I stand out on my own, all brave and alone.
Be an individual. Everybody else is.
All right, maybe I will be the individual. I think I'm going to pay for it, though, but I don't think that biomass of forest waste into fuel, that just something's not clicking there.
Okay.
All right, so I'll say it's that one.
All right, so you all agree that researchers have found they can decrease the hearing damage caused by very loud noises by pre-treating with an anti-epilepsy drug. You all agree that that's science?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
I think it is.
That one is, in fact, science.
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
Because loud noises, that causes nerve damage.
Right, exactly.
It's nerve damage.
This has been quite a problem with forces in Iraq, for example. Lots of, you know, explosive devices going off, and the loud explosion causes damage, you know, neuronal hearing damage. So what they did was they looked at they used rats, and they had various groups, some that they would treat with. There was two different anti-epilepsy drugs that they were using, and they would then expose them to a very loud bang or loud noise, and then they would measure their hearing sensitivity afterwards. And one of the groups with one of the drugs, not another one that they tested, if they were pre-treated with this drug, that there was a 5 decibel decrease in their loss of hearing. So that was pretty significant. I mean, 5 decibels would make a huge difference in like the ability to hear, you know, speech, for example.
My dad has had a hearing loss most of his adult life because dynamite went off near his head when he was a young man working at a construction site.
Really? Only he had epilepsy. the drug is a calcium channel blocker. Now, the thinking is, you think, well, how could a drug prevent physical damage from the explosion? But what happens is that this the sensory overload damages the nerves, and then those the nerve cells, the hearing nerve cells, and they die. And part of that dying process, the reason why they chose calcium channel blockers is because we know that calcium influx is often part of the process of nerve cells dying. So by blocking that, they thought maybe more of those nerve cells will survive, and that would preserve some of the hearing, and it worked. So it's pretty cool. It's certainly practically difficult. I mean, you know, I guess we could give every soldier this drug, you know, but there's
other side effects.
There's side effects and whatnot. It's not. It's there might not be any immediate applications to this, but it's always interesting. And Evan, so you're out on a limb on your own, and thinking that number three, that the new process for turning biomass into liquid fuel is fiction, and this is in fact science. Sorry, Evan.
Took a chance.
It's pretty cool. I mean, what they did was they inject hydrogen into the process, and when they do that, it triples the yield, seeing it 3 times as much as the other without injecting hydrogen into it. Now, of course, the problem there is that, you know, it takes energy to make hydrogen. You know, hydrogen ain't free. And there's no free hydrogen on the Earth. You know, hydrogen is not an energy source. It is an energy medium, but it's not a source. You can store energy in hydrogen. So we would have to, you know, if we were burning fuel to make the hydrogen, it really wouldn't work out so well. But if you had, you know, like nuclear power plants generating hydrogen, and then you're using the hydrogen to make gasoline, you know, biofuel from agriculture. The cool thing is that you don't have to, like, do it from fields of crops. You could do it just from agricultural and forest waste.
Well, like bear shit?
No, like corn husks and things like that. The kind of stuff they would leave rotting in the field, basically. Which is it. So, you know, with this kind of process, and of course, if you're using some kind of non-polluting or, you know, non-greenhouse gas creating method for creating the hydrogen, like nuclear fuel or whatever, or windmills, then that actually could, you know, make a substantial addition to, you know, our energy supply, our fuel supply. So we need some technological breakthroughs. You know, just, you know, making ethanol from corn is not going to make a dent in our fuel needs. We need something.
That's really a dead end. I mean, and they're putting a lot of resources behind it, aren't they?
Yeah,
and it's really not as viable as it's being made out to be.
That's right. it's really close to the edge in terms of whether or not you actually get more energy out of them than what you put in. And even if you take the most favorable numbers, it's only a little bit, you know, extra energy that you
right.
get. Part of the problem is that you have to use fossil fuels as fertilizer, so you know you're pouring, you know, the energy onto the fields in the first place. But anyway, so but new innovative processes like this are needed. I don't know if this particular one is going to be the one that's going to work, but it is interesting.
We should pour billions of dollars into this.
Oh God!
I'm just kidding that time.
Yeah. I saw a TV show that they were using compressed air to power cars, and it
oh.
worked really well.
What?
Yep.
I heard something.
The air-powered car. Yeah, I've read about this. I did some research on this to find out what they were talking about. And there's I watched an online show about it. It's like a TV show that you'd see online. We never talked about it, but the bottom line is, it's using compressed air. So you have to put the energy in to compress the air. That's where you're spending your energy.
Which could be done with electricity, though.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's a more efficient way. It's much quicker to refill and.
Actually not quick to refill at all. It takes a lot longer to recompress the air in these vehicles than it does to fill up a gas tank. It takes hours.
40 miles.
It takes
before
hours
you have to refuel.
Yeah, that's if you had like the wonky one that goes with the car. But if you actually went to a filling station that had a professional thing, it was a lot faster.
Right.
And then the other thing about compressed air is that when the engine does not produce a lot of heat, hardly any heat at all. So you're not losing anything to heat, which is huge with gasoline.
One big problem, though, is that they're loud. They're really loud.
That's a problem.
The engine clanks a lot. You know,
well, that's okay. Just take the anti-epilepsy drug, and you're
good. That's right. So, it's an interesting idea using compressed air, but again, it doesn't solve the problem. You still have to create the energy to compress the air. Although there was, some outlets, some reports were saying that
perpetual motion.
Yeah, it's like making sort of perpetual motion claims
right.
out of it. That's all nonsense. But yeah, sure, you can spend energy to compress the air and run engines off of that. I don't know if that technology is actually going to be viable. It may find a niche somewhere, but it's interesting. It's an interesting concept. But this all means that scientists have discovered a new species of mammal 125 million years old, which they believe to be the long-sought-after missing link in bat evolution, is...
125 or 25?
125.
I thought you said 25.
Nope, I said 125.
The whole thing's a sham.
Doesn't matter.
Fiction.
I would have changed my answer basically.
I mean, well, actually, 25 would be less plausible than 125 because bats were around more like 50 to 75 million years ago. Is when that sort of missing piece of evolution was taking place. So 125 is a little old for bats. So that's one thing that was suspicious about that. But I did pull this off the news service just today. So even if it was about bats, you guys probably wouldn't have heard about it yet, unless it certainly wouldn't have appeared yet in Bat Fancy magazine. But there was a very interesting fossil find that was announced today, documented in the March 15th Journal of Nature. There was a 125-million-year-old mammal found in China. There's some really rich fossil beds coming out of China these days.
Oh, yeah.
And what's interesting about this fossil mammal is that it has its middle ear is intermediary between the inner ear of reptiles and the inner ear of mammals.
Hello.
And all it's very, very well preserved. So it actually does have very significant implications for documenting this transition. It's a very transitional species. It's transitional from reptiles to mammals, and specifically in this one feature of the middle ear. Now
it migrated from the jaw, right?
That's the theory. So reptiles have a more complex jaw than mammals do. They have some more bones in there that mammals don't have, and it makes their jaw strong, but it also limits the motion. Like reptiles can't move their jaw from side to side, so it's not good for grinding. It just moves in the one direction, up and down. Mammals, they have a single joint jaw. Their temporomandibular joint is just a single joint. So there's a bunch of extra bones sitting there that they didn't need anymore, and those bones shrank, and they got co-opted by the ear structure, by the middle ear, and they to amplify sound, by magnifying the movement of the eardrum, and that gives mammals better hearing than reptiles. Very, very interesting. And the evolution of the jaw bones to the middle ear bones from reptiles to mammal is actually pretty well documented in the fossil record. And this is filling in this transition even further. And also, you know, again, it's one of the best specimens we have of this. So this is like the discovery recently of Tiktaalik, the sort of transition between fish and terrestrial vertebrates. This is a gap what we just filled in, you know.
It created two new
gaps. Yeah, nice. Absolutely. Going, scientists. Great. Well done. More gaps.
It is, if you know, again, from the description, sounds like it's a beautiful, well preserved transitional species.
Steve, do you think that ideas are
no? No, I like, don't.
Damn.
I
could care less.
Evidence, come on, evidence, please. They will be untouched by this.
They will move. They will move the goalposts and move on.
The name of this species is Yanoconodon, because it was found near the... named after the Yan Mountains, where it was found. So everyone won but Evan.
Yay! Now, I have to come clean here. I actually wasn't listening to you, Steve, when you were reading the questions, because I was on Mike's site, sgufans.net. I was reading some of the funny quotes from past episodes. So when I was very happy, I had Bob go first, and I simply agreed with him.
All right, so you just went along with the
crowd.
That's
a nice change of
pace. I came clean. Right. I came clean.
So you go first next week.
I'm an honest man. That's why I will not turn to the dark side, and I will stay a poverty-stricken skeptic my entire life. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, and speaking of the SGU fan site.
Yes.
We should promote the fact that there are fan sites on MySpace and on Facebook. So if anybody out there has accounts on one of those sites, check out those guys. You can probably do a search for Skeptic's Guide. Or there are links from our forum to get to those.
Cool. Yeah, so check it out. Cool. And thanks again to Mike. Cool. And the SGUfans.net site is coming along nicely. He's really putting a lot of work into it. And it's a lot
really
of fun.
Is.
Good work.
It really is.
As my favorite part of the things he's doing, is going through each episode and pulling out his favorite quotes, and it is kind of fun to read back over some of the funny quotes.
It is.
It just goes to show you how ridiculous we are. We're just a bunch of idiots.
Excuse me.
Who can barely operate computers.
Evan, tell us last week's puzzle.
Last week's puzzle was, a pirate's victim swimming in rye, bound with ropes, would make a perfect one of these. And the answer is a crop circle.
Yes, of course.
Wouldn't it be a water circle?
Pirate's victim, walking the plank, swimming in rye, field of rye, bound with ropes. You tie the plank with ropes, make a perfect circle.
That's a good puzzle.
Thank you. Congratulations to Ole. I'll pronounce this, I hope, correctly. Ivind, E-I-V-I-N-D, from the message boards, for guessing correctly, being the first one to guess correctly.
Good. Well, congratulations. And what's the puzzle for this week?
Here is this week's puzzle. If you take the 9th, the 22nd, the 8th, the 20th, and the 18th, and put them inside a vulva, what do you have?
Did you say inside a vulva?
He did.
That's exactly what I said.
Just making sure you didn't say Volvo.
Volvo.
Okay.
Very interesting.
V-U-L-V-A.
Okay.
So, is this the Seinfeld girlfriend that rhymes with the female anatomy?
Mulva?
No. Mulva.
Okay.
So good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
I mean, you're asking a bunch of nerds to come up with the answer of something you put inside a vulva. just so we're clear on this.
Yeah, that is kind of dangerous.
This thread discussion will go on to 10
years. You're really stretching to find something
week.
That they won't have any direct experience with.
Nice.
Well, Bob, do you have a quote to thankfully close out the show this week?
Please. You know, you can't hit a home run every podcast. Let's just remember that.
Yeah, right.
Make sure you use the word vulva in there.
Yes, I do. This is a quote. This is a quote from two people, apparently, Carl Sagan and Ann Druyan, and she's his wife. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
And they wrote some books together, so it's probably out of one of them.
Okay, that must be it. Their collective quote is, "The cure for a fallacious argument is a better argument, not the suppression of ideas."
Right. which we never suppress ideas.
Shut up, Steve.
Stop talking.
Sorry, it's late and I'm cranky.
All right, everyone. Thanks again for joining me. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Welcome back, Jay.
Welcome back.
I'm not happy to be home, but...
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Endless delays.